This is, I think, the slowest growth since the 1930s. We grew about at the same rate as the rest of the country.
Alaska gets a big batch of census data from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 16th of March. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Representative Sharon Cisna vents her frustrations over the TSA screening process on Capitol Hill.
It's the feel-up I don't like. It's not a pat-down.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
The situation today at Japan's troubled nuclear plant appears to be deteriorating. There has been a surge in radiation levels, and U.S. officials say spent fuel rods could be on the verge of spewing radioactive material. But officials in Alaska aren't concerned the situation could pose a health risk to Alaskans. Dr. Bernd Gilley is director of the State of Alaska Public Health Lab. He calls the radiation risk to Alaskans infinitesimally small.
According to the best of minds available here in the state, we think there is a next to zero chance, even if it goes into a Chernobyl-sized disaster, in that we are about 5,000 miles away from the incident site, and you do get the dilution factor. And it would have to go really high into the atmosphere in order to be carried this far.
Still, Dr. Gilley says the health department is monitoring the Environmental Protection Agency's radiation sampling station in Anchorage.
We cannot see any significant changes. I mean, there's day-to-day variations due to sunspot activities and everything else that happens around. But we see no increase in activity.
The EPA currently has another radiation sampling station in Fairbanks, and the agency is in the process of deploying three more radiation monitors in Alaska, in Nome, Dutch Harbor, and Juneau. Alaska received its 2010 census numbers today. Overall, the state's population grew, but many areas of rural Alaska lost residents. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The state population grew by about 13% between 2000 and 2010. State economist Neil Fried says that compares pretty well to the growth rate between 1990 and 2000.
We grew 14% the previous decade. This is, I think, the slowest growth since the 1930s. We grew about at the same rate as the rest of the country. So these past two decades have been pretty similar. But then when you start looking at the details, the stories, is more dramatic.
The most dramatic number is probably the population growth rate in the Mat-Su Valley. It was 50%, the fastest in the state. Fried says it also grew 50% during the previous decade.
What's more amazing about it for this decade is that, we're not talking about small numbers. We're talking about, sometimes it's easy to grow by 50%, if you're looking at a very small base. But when you're looking at a base, their official population for 2010 was 88,995. So that was an increase of almost 30,000. Well, that's bigger than almost every other community in the state alone, just their growth.
Fried says very few other places in the state grew rapidly during this last decade, and several areas in the state lost population. The Yukon-Koyukuk area had the largest decline at almost 15%. The Dillingham census area, Kodiak Island, and the Ketchikan-Gateway borough also lost population.
In a lot of places, their population has grown, but grown fairly slowly. You look at the Bethel area, for example, the YK Delta area, and it grew, but it grew slowly. The state grew by 13%. They grew by 6%. You look at the Nome region, it also grew some, but only by about 3%. Southeast Alaska, there are a lot of places where the population has declined.
Population numbers on race and ethnicity were also released today. Fried says those changes are more difficult to assess, but there are some larger trends.
We all know that, you know, our population is gotten increasingly diverse. I mean, that's really stood out in our school age population, but our overall population as well. Groups like the Hispanic population has grown very significantly. The Native Alaskan population has grown faster than average. The Asian population has also grown quite dramatically.
And Fried says overall, Alaska's growth rate was large enough to tip Alaska's total population over 700,000 for the first time.
Our official population for 2010 was 710,211. So, you know, in casual conversation as Alaskans, we can now, when someone asks us that question, it's a very common question. Well, more than 700,000 people live here.
Fried says in previous census counts, there would still be a lot more data to come from the long form. That was socioeconomic data. But the census has decided to release that information more frequently in the form of an annual survey. Fried says the jury is still out on whether it will do an adequate job replacing the long form data. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The state's redistricting board began its work today after receiving the new census figures. The redistricting board has 30 days to draft initial plans for new political boundaries and 60 days to finalize those plans. This morning, the board heard public comments from a variety of people, including Randy Riedrich, chairman of the Alaska Republican Party. Riedrich is asking the board to consider assigning Alaska prisoners to their home addresses instead of their prison address in building new legislative districts. Riedrich says the move could allow greater population figures for rural districts, reducing the need to expand those districts and reducing the risk of creating districts with a voting majority. Redistricting Board Chair John Torgerson said the item, as well as another question regarding the military population in Alaska, are among the intricate legal issues the board will be discussing.
It's an interesting concept that if it might move some population back into some of the districts that have lost population. And my understanding is only three states in the nation that do that. And I just don't know if that's something that we can do on our own or if that's something that we'll need statutory guidelines on.
Five state house districts lost 17% of their population between 2002 and last year. Conversely, the state's population has grown by more than 83,000 people since the year 2000. About one-third of that growth is in the Matanuska-Susitna borough. City clerks from Wasilla, Palmer, and Valdez spoke up before the board, too. Christy Spenders, representing the Alaska Association of Municipal Clerks, said it is the clerk's job to see that all registered city voters get ballots, and redistricting could result in changes in voting precincts.
Although the State Division of Elections only runs their elections every other year, we as municipal clerks run our elections every year. And the public comes to us, and what you guys do impacts our municipality. And then the public comes to us and asks, you know, why did this happen? Why do I have to drive by three precincts to get to my precinct? And why do I have to drive 14 miles to get to my precinct?
Torgerson responded that the State Division of Elections draws up voting precinct boundaries, not the redistricting board, although the board will take clerks' concerns into consideration. Most comments at the session were more general in nature.
I think people have justifiable questions that they've asked. Some we could answer here. This really wasn't a question and answer period. A few folks did ask some questions that the board will deliberate on. A lot of them were guideline related.
The new census numbers will be used to determine the boundaries of state legislative districts for the coming decade. Wednesday's redistricting board session is expected to establish a public hearing process. Information on the board's work can be found at akredistricting.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, global warming fuels a bug explosion in the state.
Last year was just a boom year for them. I mean, we were just inundated with calls. Then there was all these moths that were flying around everywhere.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD. Paper applications are available at the same 270 statewide locations as last year. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Alaska State Representative Sharon Cisna was the star witness at a U.S. House hearing today. The Transportation Security Administration was under scrutiny in Washington for its use of full body scans and hands-on examinations. Cisna told members of a House Oversight Subcommittee about her experience getting what she describes as an invasive pat-down at the Seattle-Tacoma Airport last month. Cisna is a breast cancer survivor and has scars from a mastectomy that showed up in a full body scan. When a TSA worker insisted on touching her, Cisna refused. She was not allowed to fly, so she left the airport and made the long trip to Alaska by road and ferry instead. Cisna told the committee that the innocent phrase pat down didn't begin to describe what she went through the first time she had to get a body search after her scars registered on a scanner.
It's the feel up I don't like. It's not a pat down.
Cisna said after the hearing that the first invasive body search was a horrible experience for her, and she vowed never to go through it again.
Either the chairperson or one of the other people on the committee mentioned sexual assault, and that's exactly what it was to me. It was sexual assault, and I reacted with horror, nightmares. It was not until, and it was my husband that was kind of saying, Sharon, you have to deal with this, my coming up with the decision that I would never do it again, that I would never, ever do this again.
Members of Congress praised Cisna for sharing her story. The top representative on oversight issues, California Republican Daryl Issa, said after the hearing that Congress has heard from minority groups which believe they're being racially profiled, but that Cisna's testimony brought a new perspective on who is being affected by the TSA rules.
The laws and protections are not there for the many. It's there for the few. It's there to protect those who would otherwise be mistreated or the system falls apart. And because you happen to be not Muslim, not Arab, it's particularly important to say, look, this is happening to all Americans, which means it's failing for all Americans.
Issa says that he's against them not only because they are, in his opinion, invasive, but because he believes they're a waste of money. Sharon Cisna isn't alone in her experience. Her written testimony included letters she's received from Americans who have also felt assaulted or invaded by the TSA pat-downs. She says she's now a part of a movement of people fighting the TSA rules. A Fairbanks company that wants to build a small diameter gas line from the North Slope is fighting an uphill battle to gain state support. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the project offers a limited scope but a vastly cheaper price tag.
Energy Acura builds and operates pipelines in Alaska, but its Arctic Fox gas line is the biggest thing it's ever undertaken. The small local outfit proposes a 12-inch diameter gas line running along the highways between Prudhoe Bay and Fairbanks to supply major interior consumers. Energy Acura principal partner Alex Gatos says the project presents a new model for Alaska.
What's called utility value, which is the worth of the given resource for local consumption.
Energy Acura held an open season, and eight of the interior's largest consumers, including electric utilities and oil refiners, expressed interest. Gatos says the gas project swaps shorter-term export profits in favor of longer-spectrum local energy savings.
Whereas the interior community pays on the order of $22 per MCF, assuming it was gas energy equivalent, this pipeline system, sized appropriate to the interior's market, a 12-inch pipeline, would deliver that gas for $9.66 per MCF, less than half.
The savings hinge on a low capital cost pipeline. Energy Acura's other principal partner, Tom Chapman, says their pipeline price smashes the monster numbers attached to Alaska's other gas line options.
$7 billion, $30 billion, $50 billion. We're talking less than one. And people say, oh, you couldn't possibly do it for that. And they don't realize that the cost of steel on a pipeline is a major factor. When you reduce the diameter by half, you're reducing the amount of steel by more than a factor of more than three, which is a huge cost reduction.
Also contributing to the $700 million price tag is the lack of big upfront costs for export facilities or gas treatment. The project's relatively small volume allows it to buy pre-treated gas from North Slope producers. Energy Acura's Gatos estimates the 400-mile gas line could be laid down in 2 years, but not without help. The company's plan calls for financing the project by selling shares to Alaskans and bartering with the state.
Instead of requesting subsidies for this project, like all the other projects are asking, what we would do is return to the state 7.2% of equity in this company in exchange for its pipeline development information, data, and easements.
Energy Acura has meticulously researched the construction and operational economics, but the project hasn't gotten much traction outside Fairbanks. Federal Gas Line Coordinator Larry Persily is skeptical.
I don't think you can build a pipeline in 3 years. There's just, you can't build a high school in 3 years. We're talking federal lands, environmental impact statement, BLM. It's just not that easy, I don't believe, and I'm not sure about the cost either. But if they can, that's great.
Persily is shepherding the larger Aegea and Denali gas line projects. Fairbanks State Senator and Energy Committee co-chair Joe Pascvan says the Energy Acura proposal could get more attention if the bigger industry-led projects don't pan out.
If the large diameter line, for example, isn't going to be constructed for 15 or 20 years, then the smaller diameter line at a much cheaper cost, and when one looks at the avoided costs of energy to the interior market, then it really starts to make a lot of sense.
While a Fairbanks legislator might think so, there's still the big question of South Central Alaska gas demand. The legislature passed a bill last year that's charged the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation with leading a state team to look at gas supply options. And AHFC CEO Dan Fowsky says a pipeline terminating in Fairbanks doesn't fit the bill.
We can't stop at Fairbanks. We must keep going. So, but it's not over with yet. We're still talking to them and we're exchanging ideas. And they've changed some of their ideas. I know when I first met with Alex, I said, "Yeah, 12-inch line doesn't do us much good." And he had said, "Well, maybe we can swell the line up." And then they went back and meaning making it bigger. And so I know they're working on ideas as well.
Fowsky says the AHFC's preferred route is from Prudhoe Bay down the Parks Highway to Anchorage. Energy Acura has recently outlined a bigger 18-inch diameter pipeline option that would supply Anchorage, and the company is stepping up efforts to educate Alaskans about the potential of both projects. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
Four-time Iditarod champ Lance Mackey arrived in Nome this morning at 8:55 with seven dogs in harness and a big smile on his face. Although the crowd was thinner than he was used to from the last four races, Mackey fans lined the finish chute.
It was nice to see people out this early. I didn't have to be first to still have a fan club. That was nice.
Over the past 4 years, Mackey has dominated the Iditarod sled dog race and this year had ambitions to make it 5 wins in a row, but the 40-year-old Fairbanks musher didn't seem upset with his 16th place finish this morning.
So when people ask me if I'm disappointed, I just look sad. I just have to laugh. But I tell you what, this team will be remembered next year and the year after. I'm building a nice one here. But the one thing that I realized driving a small team is I'm out of shape.
Mackey says he's looking forward to bringing this team to Nome again in next year's Iditarod. Alaska Railroad officials say work on a $200 million bridge and flood control project across the Tanana River at Salcha will not begin next month. In fact, they say the project may not happen at all. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The Alaska Railroad's proposal to build what would be the state's longest bridge is in trouble. The project faces two big obstacles, a $44 million funding shortfall and state and federal regulators who believe the bridge should be built elsewhere. Railroad President and CEO Christopher Adnison says solutions have to be found quickly because the construction season is fast approaching, and if the railroad doesn't get the necessary permits and get work going soon, it will lose some $120 million in federal funding. And with it, any chance that the bridge will be built anytime soon, if ever.
We either start it this summer or we don't do it, is basically where it stands. So the various things that have to come together to proceed with this project need to come together by May.
Railroad officials had planned to begin work next month on the 3,000-foot-long bridge and flood control system in Salcha. The bridge would be the first and biggest part of the $800 million Northern Extension, an 80-mile stretch of track that the railroad proposes to build from Eielson Air Force Base to military training ranges near Fort Greely. Adnison says the railroad has pushed back the startup of work on the bridge to May at the earliest because of concerns over the project raised by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. EPA officials said last fall they won't approve the project because their analysis shows the bridge and levee system could damage salmon and whitefish habitat. But project manager Brian Lindemood says EPA initially had no problems with the proposal, and then late last year reversed itself and raised concerns about the location and design of the bridge. That after one federal agency had already approved the project and the Army Corps of Engineers was nearing a decision on issuing the permit to build the bridge.
The points that they are holding up the Corps permit on are points that directly contradict their positions in years past.
Michael Zerlog with the EPA's Seattle office says agency officials have told the Corps of Engineers that they believe the railroad should consider its alternative locations and proposals, which they believe will not harm fish species nor the river itself.
We believe that there are other alternatives that would not have those impacts to aquatic resources.
Adnison hopes to get a decision from the Corps this week, and he hopes to get the EPA to go along with it. But an okay from the Corps and EPA is only the first hurdle the railroad must clear to get the bridge built. The other is a money issue, a $44 million funding gap that Adnison hopes legislators will fill by doubling the $40 million they appropriated for the project last year. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Climate change may pose some major problems for humans, but for bugs, it's a playground on steroids. Johanna Urich reports that warmer, longer summers are setting the stage for some new insect players in Alaska.
Have you noticed some dead alders in South Central Alaska recently? That's not the work of moose. It's the green alder sawfly, a new species in Alaska. And it's kind of a mystery as to how it got here.
It's not found in any other areas.
Michael Racy is the integrated pest management technician with the Cooperative Extension Service. He says the sawfly may have arrived on a ship.
Just found a suitable environment and was able to get established without many people even noticing it. Who notices defoliation on alder for the most part?
A hiker might notice, but most of them wouldn't think dead alders a problem. Just less brush to battle through. But alders are very important ecologically, a keystone species. They feed moose and help keep the banks of streams from eroding, among other things. At a recent conference organized by the Alaska Botanical Garden, Racy showed pictures of parts of South Central Alaska where streams were lined with dead gray alder brush. But even as close as your garden, the impact of climate change is easy to see. The longer growing seasons mean many things that were marginal 20 years ago are now thriving. But so are the bugs. Last summer, little green looper caterpillars were everywhere in South Central Alaska, defoliating birches and willows alike. away from the traffic, you could hear them grinding away at the greenery. They weren't imports. They were locals taking advantage of the longer, drier summers.
Last year was just a boom year for them. I mean, we were just inundated with calls. Then there was all these moths that were flying around everywhere. I mean, it was amazing. And they flew late into the fall as well, so they were still flying in October. You know, just given the sheer amount of moths that were flying last fall, I think gardeners should expect to probably have a lot of looper caterpillars this springtime.
The Arctic is particularly susceptible to insect infestations. Boreal forests and tundras simply don't have as many different kinds of species of plants as more temperate biomes. That means they can act a bit like monocultures, in that when dry, hot weather weakens them and swings the balance to an insect, huge areas can be affected very quickly. That's what happened in the 80s when the spruce bark beetle stopped being a bit player in the forest and took center stage, turning much of the forest into acres of dead trees.
The perfect storm as far as an insect that went from obscurity to now it's the main character.
Since then, our average temperatures have continued to climb, prompting foresters and agriculturalists to worry that if an invasive species like the Asian gypsy moth were to get a foothold here, the devastation would dwarf the damage caused by spruce bark beetles. The state and cooperative extension have set up traps to try to detect invasive species early. Racy says they have already caught an Asian gypsy moth in Fairbanks.
Actually, the egg mass or the larva or the adult was actually brought up on an RV, and then the RV stopped at a campground or at a park, and then it flew to one of our gypsy moth traps. So let's trap there more often next year just to make sure that they haven't become established.
Officials hope they can prevent the worst of the invasive species from damaging our forests, but they can't be everywhere in our vast state. They need the help of gardeners and observant residents. Cooperative Extension has set up a website to help citizens keep an eye out for strange bugs. I'm Johanna Urich.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta, Deanna Hecker in Nome, and Johanna Urich in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message sponsored by the Native American Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.